back on the chain gang, folks, doing the heavy lifting of sorts. Hey, it's radio. All right, play along. Let's talk here for a Wednesday morning program. We will have a little bit more open line time toward the end of this hour. But again, come on, folks. I know you politics. You love talking about politics. Yes, you do. And we welcome back our friend, Dr. Michael Berkman, Penn State political science professor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Whoop, let me make sure I get the right. Go ahead. Say good morning.
Good morning.
There we go. That works. Hey,
better.
It's amazing what happens when you push the right buttons. Okay, it's been a fun 3 months.
It's been quite 100 days.
When is 100 days? That's
well,
next week.
I'm not quite sure, but we're right around the 100-day mark. Yeah.
About now.
Yeah, I think we're at 3 months, which is what I heard
okay.
last night
All
from somebody.
Right.
It's been quite 100 days.
All right.
I've never seen anything like it.
We will get on to that in just a little bit.
Yep.
We'll save the heavy stuff for a little later. When we've had you on, I'm very interested in education,
mm-hmm.
and we've done shows with Penn State students, and in this case, talking about politics and stuff like that. It's been a lot of fun. You're a political science professor, and here we go. We're coming up to the end of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, graduation day, I guess, is the 10th of May. What's your schedule like the next 2 weeks? Is this like cramming or what happens?
It's a busy time. Yeah. So classes are quite busy. People are completing final projects, preparing for final exams, which take place obviously during finals week. Students are, beyond all the fun that goes on in the spring, they're finalizing internship plans, figuring out what they're doing next year. And then everything slows down.
All right.
And
how many political science student majors are there?
Ooh, I should know that, but I don't.
Round
where I think we're the third largest major in the college.
Wow.
After psychology and economics. But I'm not in the department administration, so I may have those numbers. I may not have those numbers just right. And I couldn't even guess at a number.
I mean, 100? 200?
No, several hundred at least.
Several hundred?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have, we operate three majors, political science major, international politics, and something called social data analytics. We also offer the political science degree as both a BS and a BA. So we have a lot of things going on and a lot of students.
BS, by the way, is Bachelor of Science.
Yes, and a Bachelor of
Not
arts.
The other BS?
Yes, not the other BS. That's another major.
What was that third one? Social data?
Social data analytics, yeah.
What is that?
So this is a major that's kind of a marriage of big data analytics, which is an area that our department has a lot of strength at the graduate and research level. And it's designed with other social science majors, and so it's teaching students how to use basically big data sets with different kinds of social science questions, whether it's sociology or political science.
Every time I turn around, doctor, data,
yeah.
Data's like everywhere. But haven't we always had data? Is this a relatively new major?
It is a relatively new major, and, the whole... Whew. I'm not an expert in this area, but I had to say over the last 10 years or so, we've really seen an explosion of big data kinds of programs. And what's happened is we have new statistical techniques. And so we're able to use much larger data sets than we ever could before. Computing power is a lot more efficient than it used to be. So it's not going to take 4 days to run some sort of analysis. We also have access to sort of data sets that we never did before. So there's certainly in my discipline, there's a lot of work that's done in the field of text to data. So that's the conversion of text into data. For a long time, people were working with different types of Twitter data. So Twitter tweets turned into data. So, government data, all kinds of different data that can come in very, very large data sets.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And many of our students are graduate students are very well trained in this. And then at the undergraduate level, we try to introduce students to it.
Hmm. Interesting. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a What's a final look like for your students? Is it multiple choice, fill in the blank, or is it more than
that? Yeah, I'm probably not the best person for finding out what's going on in the classroom because I administer the McCourtney Institute, so I don't teach that much. And what I do teach are lower level classes. So my final exam will be, like my other exams this semester, it'll be multiple choice, drawing heavily from the textbook, and it will be some open-ended questions that draw more largely from reading. And lectures.
Now, you mentioned internships. I was going to ask about that because I assume there are students that, I guess, for the summer, they become interns of who, what? I mean, where do they go?
Well, that's all a bit of a mess this summer.
Uh-oh.
So previous summers, I'd say, sure, we send people down to Capitol Hill. We send them to different agencies within Washington. Remember, we're political science. We send them to different interest groups, all that kind of thing. But it has been very challenging to set up internships this summer because of the uncertainty in Washington. So departments, agencies have no idea what kind of internships they might have. They don't even know if they're going to be working next week. And so we've had a very difficult time setting up internships. And in fact, I think we might have, the department anyway, might have canceled its summer internship program, which is impossible to set anything up.
Wow.
Now, students may find internships by themselves, and I know some that have. And out of the McCourtney Institute, which I'm involved with, we have our own internship program where we fully pay for students to do their internships, and we send them not to Washington, but to programs around the country that are doing different kinds of work in democracy.
What about Harrisburg?
We have students that do internships in Harrisburg, quite a few. I'm not that involved with our undergraduate programs here, so I don't know how many might be going down there, but certainly over the years we've had plenty of students.
Or other state capitals.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because not every Penn Stater's from Pennsylvania. We got kids from everywhere.
Absolutely. And sometimes the more interesting work is in the state capitals because they can get much more involved with things.
Now, you mentioned international. What about overseas? Internships overseas, maybe?
I've known that to be the case in the past, but again, there's just so much uncertainty these days, it's hard for me to say what's going to happen this summer.
Interesting. All right. Very interesting.
Uncertainty is the word of the word of the hour, I think. There is a lot of uncertainty in Washington about everything. We're feeling it just in the development of these internship programs.
All right. Now, when we communicated recently, and you're like, what are we going to talk about? I said one thing I absolutely want to talk about, which I think a lot of Americans really don't understand, is the separation of powers between. Now, folks, we're going back to school. Okay, come on, play with me here. Executive branch, legislative branch, judicial branch. Come on, you know those three, right? They haven't changed. The checks and balances and all that sort of thing, because clearly we've got a president now who's pushing the envelope to see what he can either get done or get away with. All right. Now, some of you may disagree with that, but come on. I mean, take a look. And I just wanted to, you know, you're expert and so on in Washington and such. Let's describe this separation of powers, which we've had from the Constitution, very beginning. First off, what is it? Let's talk about the separation of powers, the three branches. How does all that supposed to work?
Right. So when the framers, in particular James Madison, was designing the Constitution, they were very concerned with the idea of power being concentrated in the hands of any one individual or any one branch of government. So they were drawing from the French philosopher Montesquieu in this, that powers had to be separated to prevent tyranny from developing in the government. And so they were very careful about that, and they gave the power of the purse to the legislature, they gave the power of the sword to the executive, and the judicial branch, which they were concerned would not actually have sufficient power, was basically given the power of judicial review over the decisions made by the other two branches of government. Each was designed to have a sufficient power to check the other branch of government. So the president could check Congress by vetoing a bill, but Congress could check the executive by overriding that veto. The court could check either one by finding what they did to be unconstitutional. That could be overridden by a constitutional amendment. the final the actions of a president may be so outrageous that Congress has to use its final check, which is the power to impeach the president or the power to impeach a member of the court. This is how it was designed to be. And further, and this is why, you know, if any of your listeners really want to go to school, why Federalist 51 is considered so important, Federalist Paper number 51, they believed that each branch would have sufficient people with sufficient ambition that they would want to protect the branch against other branches of government, so that members of the legislature would have distinct interests from members from the executive branch, that they would pursue those through the legislature, and they would protect the institutional integrity of their branch of government. So I think if what we're seeing right now is somewhat of a breakdown in this, in a couple of directions. Congress has clearly sort of abdicated its duty to check the executive. Now, it's not the first time we've seen this, because when they designed the Constitution, they weren't really thinking about political parties, although they should have been. And so the political party of the executive is the same as the Congress. It's not just now. We've seen that at many times. And therefore, they're going to work together more than they're necessarily going to check one another. But there have been various times in history where Congress has really stepped up and asserted its authority against the president. You know, in the 1970s, they passed a congressional, the Impoundment Act to prevent the executive from impounding funds. They passed the War Powers Act to prevent the president from just going to war. They passed an act that said that if the president used emergency powers, like Trump is now, that Congress would have an override on these executive powers. So a variety of these were put into place. What we're seeing now, I mean, I think your statement that the president is pushing the bounds is a very good way of putting it. That's exactly what's happening. You know, there are over 200 lawsuits right now against the administration. These are dealing with a whole range of issues, but some of these are these separation of powers issues. For example, the way the president just impounded funds across multiple agencies is to many a violation of the Impoundment and Control Act. The way DOGE is firing employees might be a violation of civil service rules. So there are all these kinds of different battles that are going on that do have a lot to do with the separation of powers. And I apologize for too long an answer.
No, that's perfect.
Complicated area.
No, it is a complicated area.
Yeah.
And it's just like seemingly every day, boom, 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 there's something new.
Well,
you mentioned all these lawsuits.
Yeah.
That's never happened before.
No, there are these litigation trackers that I check every once in a while. So it was like 202 earlier in the week. It was 203 later in the week. And I was just sort of curious. I took the Wayback Machine and I looked at it for about 6 weeks ago, and it was only 125. And, you know, so it's accelerating at a fairly rapid rate. And I don't think we've ever seen anything like that before. We've also never had litigation trackers, so I wouldn't even know how to be sure. But usually when presidents come in their 100 days, the instinct is to try to work with Congress, see what they can do. The president usually comes in with some sort of legislative agenda. What's so striking about what I think Trump is doing is that he wants to give really the appearance of action. And so executive orders allow him to act really quickly all over the place. You know, many of them won't be upheld, and many of them could just be easily overturned, but they give the appearance of action, and they do cause the bureaucracy to do things. You know, but he doesn't, in what I've seen, have much of a legislative agenda. And, you know, presumably he could get a bit bogged down when things do finally move into the Congress and he tries to get through whatever kind of tax cut they're talking about and trying to get through a budget. I don't know that there's really much more beyond that that they're trying to do through the legislature.
Where are all these lawsuits coming from? Members of Congress? Just people? I mean, who's doing all this stuff?
Well, often, you know, organizations on behalf of people. So the ACLU is involved in a lot of suits on behalf of deportees, for example. There are all these due process suits that are coming up. You know, Harvard has very good lawyers that it hires on its own. They happen to actually be very, very well-known Republican lawyers that they're using. So there are immigrants' rights groups that are representing immigrants in a variety of migrants in a variety of these lawsuits, and some are just individual people, you know, or institutions that feel like they were wronged.
Okay,
there might be some from members of Congress too. You know, there are also a series of lawsuits that are coming from the states. And so this is something we've seen for quite a long time. I mean, I think Josh Shapiro kind of cut his teeth as attorney general suing the first Trump administration. Ted Cruz cut his teeth when he was in Texas suing the Obama administration. There's the lawsuit coming from Maine, I believe, from the governor of Maine.
Yes.
And there are other lawsuits out there as well that are coming from the states. You know, the framers intended two main limits on the concentration of power. We talked about separation of powers as one. The other was federalism, which divides power between the states and national government. And we see that as especially blue states kind of push back through lawsuits and other sorts of actions.
So the really happy people right now are lawyers.
Well, not the ones that got attacked by the that the administration went after and denied access to the White House. They're not having such a good time. But yeah, I guess it's a good season to be a lawyer.
All right.
Yeah.
So
is it ever not a good season to be a lawyer?
The so-called founding fathers set this all up almost 250 years ago. And I mean, I'm trying to think of England, Magna Carta. There was nothing like this. Or was there before the Constitution? Was there something Constitution-like somewhere? You mentioned France and so on. Before the Constitution showed up, was it that monumentally different, or we just stole a bunch of ideas from other people?
Well, both. I mean, yes, I think it was monumentally different as a Constitution. I'm not sure there was any other there was no other constitutional democracy at the time when the when we formed our constitution. But we, without a doubt, I mean, the framers were well-educated men, and they drew quite heavily on the experiences of ancient Athens, on Rome, on drawing from philosophers like Montesquieu, and I mean, John Locke's thoughts are all over the Declaration of Independence. So it's not like they're working in a vacuum, but they certainly created something that was original, and that required them to make some very, very challenging and maybe even immoral sorts of compromises in order to sort of pull the South along in this constitutional project.
I keep hearing the phrase constitutional crisis, and I'm thinking, is that true, or people just, they need to blow and vent? Are there anything that's happened in the last 3 months? Is it really a constitutional crisis, or is it Trump just, I'm going to push and push and see what I can get away with?
Yeah.
Which I don't see as a crisis. He's playing the game, and he's pushing, and we'll see where it ends up. What do you think?
I've tended to believe that we have a constitutional crisis when one branch of government is not following the legitimate expectations of another branch of government. Let me put that in another way. We have a constitutional crisis if the Supreme Court tells the president to do something and he says no. That could be a constitutional crisis. And have we reached that point? I don't really think so. I think that the courts give the government a huge amount of leeway when negotiating, when pursuing lawsuits. Courts tend to sort of side with the government, they negotiate with the government. And one thing you might notice, for example, in Roberts' decision about the Garcia case, in the court's decision. And so it was an interesting decision. It was 9-0. They said that, you know, migrants have due process rights, so they're entitled to due process. That was a unanimous decision. But then they wrote the decision in such a way that didn't say you must go get this guy and bring him back to the United States, but rather gave them leeway. I said you need to facilitate it. Well, what does facilitate mean? So it gave them leeway, because I think that what Roberts really doesn't want to do is create a situation where the Supreme Court tells the president, you have to do this, and he says, no, I'm not going to do it. That, I think, is potentially a constitutional crisis. But I'll offer another way of thinking about it, which is more like, that's like a crisis as an episode. We get to this point and we're in crisis, though. Other people might think of it more like the climate crisis. And that is a sort of condition that we're in, where the president has clearly been, I don't want to say not shown deference to the court. He's downright insults the court continuously, in a way that sort of suggests that he doesn't respect their authority. And I think that creates a general feeling of lawlessness. I think there are other things that have contributed to a feeling of lawlessness, too, like pardoning the January 6th people. And so that, to me, is kind of a crisis, but it's a crisis. It's a slow burn crisis. It's more like a condition that we're in. If there are 200 lawsuits against the administration in the first 100 days, it could mean that lawyers are just looking to make some money. Or it could mean that maybe there's something of a crisis going on.
All right, I just put my hands like, yes, lawyers trying to make money.
Yes.
There we go.
That's
Bing.
Really part of it, too.
Where's my bell? I've got to ring the bell there. We'll take a break in just a moment. Now, you mentioned what is the check on the judicial branch? Now, you say, okay, they can pass a constitutional amendment. Well, good luck with that. That takes a lot of heavy lifting to put a new amendment in the Constitution. And this isn't just recently. Now, maybe I'm wrong, Doctor. You tell me. It just seems like for years, whoever the president is at that time will make a decision, and out it goes, and somebody somewhere will find some federal judge someplace who will make a pronouncement, no, you can't do that. And so one federal judge in some who knows where stops everything.
Yeah,
did I describe that accurately?
Yes, I mean, this is something that's been driving the administration crazy, that district judges can make decisions that, you know, put nationwide injunctions on things. But they are allowed to do that. And, you know, if the perception is by courts above the district court that, man, they shouldn't have done this, this is too broad, then they have the appeals process. So, I mean, the court system is self-correcting. You can always appeal. And one thing I think that the Trump administration is clearly trying to do here is flood the courts with so many cases, right? The Supreme Court's going to have to take some of them. I don't know which ones. But they want all these to get to the Supreme Court so that they can try to push the boundaries of what's acceptable. Like, I don't think that they think, oh, we're going to win all these. They know they're going to lose some of them. And they may even think, oh, we're going to lose on some, we're going to win on some, you know, win something on some of them and lose others on some. But at least they're pushing forward. And I think that's somewhat of a plan. I hear them attacking district judges, you know, because there is this notion of venue shopping. You look around for the courts that are going to work to your advantage. They're doing it too, keep in mind. I mean, the reason they're whisking people down to Louisiana is because the circuit court down there is the most conservative circuit court in the country, right? So they do it too. But yes, they're concerned about the district judges doing this. But to my knowledge, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but to my knowledge, they're perfectly allowed to do this. And if they're not, upper levels will turn them over. Now, you asked to check on the courts. You want me?
Yeah.
So there are multiple checks on the court. Remember, Roosevelt's check on the court was to threaten to enlarge it. Because Roosevelt was upset with a series of decisions that were, in effect, not allowing the New Deal to go forward. And this was what we, in political science courses, switch in time that saved nine, where the court literally turned on a dime in its decisions about the constitutionality of many provisions of the New Deal, because Roosevelt said, well, I'll just add five of you. And I'll appoint those five, and we won't have a problem anymore. The size of the court, that's set by Congress. They can change that at any time. They can't change the lifetime tenure, and you're right. The framers set up this amendment process. They knew it would be tough. I don't know if they knew it would be this tough to get amendments through.
Yeah.
And I also think they thought the impeachment process would work in a way that it's clearly not, because it's become so partisan.
I mean, impeachment is pointless now.
Yes.
I mean, it's because it's happened multiple times. In recent years.
And it's just another partisan exercise. But even with Nixon, it largely was. But the difference was they had enough Republicans that were willing to come forward to say, you got to get out before this happens.
All right. Let's take a break right here. Again, our guest is Dr. Michael Berkman, Penn State political science professor. Franklin Roosevelt, not the other one. I want to compare him and Trump when we come back, because I don't know, I see similarities in different ways. Democrat, Republican, okay. All right, friends, let's see if we can learn a few things here on a Wednesday morning, okay? You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox. All right, conversations, not arguments. I like those. We'll see if we can do some more of that when we come right back.
Get that feeling. Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox is where you will hear Paul Skeens pitch.
Swing and a miss, another strikeout for Skeens. That's four through two innings. Six up, six down for Paul Skeens.
And this is where you can learn that Key Brian Hayes is one of the best defensive players in Major League Baseball.
Bunted toward Baruchy, now to third. Hayes, bare hands, throws, and got him! Terrific play by Key Brian Hayes! Magnificent!
Or perhaps you're just wondering, how do you answer?
Swing, fly ball, deep right field, cruises in a grand slam! That's how you answer! That's how you answer!
Stay tuned for more Pirates baseball all summer long, right here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. And hopefully you remember how to properly use your Jolly Roger.
Raise the Jolly Roger!
This year's Penn State Board of Trustees election is about transparency and competence. And Pat Romano is asking for your alumni vote. Pat is a successful local business owner from Phillipsburg and a leader on the World Campus Alumni Board who believes in lowering student tuition, saving Commonwealth campuses, improving the Penn State student experience, and in honoring Joe and Sue Paterno by returning the Joe Paterno statue. Number three on your alumni ballot, Pat Romano will focus on Penn State's future and enough of the nonsense. This spring, vote for Pat Romano for the Penn State Board of Trustees.
Now a fraternity or sorority is a brotherhood or sisterhood formed around common goals and aspirations. These men and women make a commitment to each other for life. The members that form a fraternity or sorority share their efforts, friendship, and knowledge, but they should never, ever look the same. That's why there's PAMP, printing and more printing. All kinds of t-shirts for all of your group's events, with the artwork as wild as... artwork as visually stimulating as your mind's eye sees it.
For quality you can see and wear, remember PAMP for customized t-shirts, letterheads, envelopes, magnetic signs, and business cards. PAMP has a low minimum of 12 shirts for printing and no minimum on embroidered items. They don't charge art fees or setup fees. Pricing is simple and easy, and they have a quick turnaround. They're open Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Located at 136 South Harrison Road, Pleasant Gap. For more information, call 814-359-2447.
As you look out onto your yard or acreage, you know it's coming. Lots of work and time. You may be excited about it because you have a Kubota from Daughter Equipment, which actually makes chores fun and frees up your time for other things. Or maybe you're looking at the lawn and acreage with a scowl because you don't even know if your lawn and garden equipment will even start. You need to get to Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64, for Kubota and the answers. If it's your first tractor, it's hard to decide how much horsepower you're looking for, what implements you'll need. Whether you're gardening or landscaping and keeping up with property maintenance, just being behind the wheel of a Kubota makes you appreciate the Kubota Compact Tractor for its simplicity and ease. Your destination for Kubota is Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64.
Let's talk for a Wednesday, an absolutely gorgeous Wednesday. So it's not worth arguing, okay? So we're not going to do that. All right, we're having a good conversation here, trying to, I don't know, learn some things with our friend Dr. Michael Berkman, Penn State political science professor. All right, now you mentioned Roosevelt earlier, as in Franklin Roosevelt. I don't know, maybe we could actually toss Teddy in there, possibly. But when I think Franklin Roosevelt, 1930s, he comes in with this ambitious agenda, New Deal, all these things he wants to do. Okay, he gets in. All right, let's get going. Am I correct that when we say the first 100 days, that started with him?
Yeah, I guess.
Did it not, right? Right, it started with FDR.
Yeah.
So do me a favor, compare FDR and Donald Trump, like these 3 months of the beginning of an administration. I see similarities. What do you think?
I guess you could say that it's similar in terms of the level of activity, right? There's been a lot of activity in both. I mean, the Roosevelt first 100 days, Roosevelt administration was an entirely different kind of story, because Roosevelt had huge congressional majorities, and everything that he did, a lot on the war side, but what he did domestically, he did through Congress and passing of legislation. And in fact, when Roosevelt comes in, the presidency is not really that big an institution, the executive branch. It's built under Roosevelt, and it's built by Congress, passing laws that build, you know, the Department of Agriculture and all these huge departments in Washington, D.C., and these are all underneath the president. So it's Roosevelt using the Congress to build executive power. He also had a very ambitious agenda of programs through Congress. So I don't see Trump doing that at all, because everything Trump is doing is just through these executive orders, and they, you know, they have the power of law, but they're easily just erased by the next administration. Roosevelt built a permanent presence. He changed the entire state. Now, Trump is, I think, changing the American state, but he's doing it by eliminating and cutting things out, not by building them. So Doge was just like a bulldozer through the bureaucracy, cutting things down, not really for any particular purpose other than going after people that you could. And so, for example, newly promoted people, I learned this, that in the civil service, if you get a new promotion, then you're actually on parole or probation for that first year. They knock those people out. So that I see quite differently. The desire to be the focal point, that is very similar, I think. But this was built by Roosevelt. You know, before Roosevelt, the American people really didn't have a direct relationship with the president. And Roosevelt started these fireside chats and made himself very open and available to people, but in a very limited way. Like, people didn't even know that he was in a wheelchair. He was so able to control this information. Now, Trump, too, is always in our face, and it's kind of a continuation of this idea that the president has become the focal point. But that was started with Roosevelt. I'm not exactly sure what Trump is sort of starting for us going forward. So I get where the comparison comes in, but I think there's some real important differences, too.
Now, I don't know, though. You mentioned this, all right? So during the 30s and I guess into the 40s, FDR had big, he's a Democrat, he had big Democrat majorities in Congress the whole stretch?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much. I don't think the Democrats are going to lose Congress until Eisenhower. And, you know, part of it, too, was that the census was screwed up in there at one point. I don't remember exactly which one it was, and they didn't redistrict properly. So then all of a sudden there were a rush in new urban districts, because population had been shifting into urban areas throughout this industrializing period, you know, in the early 1900s, 1920. But the thing is, they hadn't really reapportioned Congress. And so when they did that, all of a sudden Democrats had huge majorities. Roosevelt could do whatever he wanted. Really, the only thing standing in his way were the courts. And concerns from Southern Democrats about racial issues, which worked its way into the New Deal in all kinds of ways. But Trump hasn't been able to, has no legislative majorities really to speak of. The Senate's not filibuster proof. And the House, it's so thin, you know, it's kind of up to whoever's not in the hospital on that day.
Although I'm wondering, here's my thought. Now, Roosevelt was a politician, former governor of New York, did other things in government, and then he becomes president. Donald Trump's a businessman, never was a politician. I'm wondering if he even had really solid majorities in Congress, that wouldn't matter. This is a businessman. I'm going to run this place like my business. I'm going to ram it through because this is what I want. What do you does that sound about right to you?
Perfectly plausible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That he is not at all oriented around the idea of working with a legislative majority. And it's true. Roosevelt was. Not only that he was a governor, but, you know, many of the ideas that he brought in came from the progressives in New York and some other states. And literally the progressive, like the Progressive Party.
So there hasn't, I'm trying to think of past presidents especially, and somebody who was just a business person. I don't think there has been anybody before this guy. I can't think of one. They were all politicians. They were governors. They were senators.
Yeah,
they came from something
Eisenhower
else.
Eisenhower was a general.
Okay, Eisenhower was a general. There's one.
Yeah.
But not a businessman.
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, Ross Perot is probably the last real businessman to make a run at.
Yeah, but he didn't serve, obviously. I'm talking
about
people that actually got
served.
Elected.
Yeah, I get that. That sounds
I mean, Eisenhower in the 50s, did he try to run everything like I'm the general of the army again?
And he was frustrated by it.
by
the fact that he couldn't run
that he couldn't.
Like he was a general in the military.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, people bring their past experience in.
All right.
I think that's absolutely accurate. And the other thing about Trump about being a businessman is I think he sees the world in transactional terms. And that too is somewhat different.
Now, all, again, tariffs and trade and all this sort of stuff. This is, what was his book? The Art of the Deal. This is the deal maker stepping in. He's going to make a whole bunch of new deals. Not new deals like Roosevelt new deals, just he's going to make a whole bunch of deals. I'm a businessman. That's what's going to happen. When I'm looking at that, that's what I see. Now, you're nodding your head. Does that sound about right?
I think there is. I find his use of the tariffs slippery, you know. So on the
one, what does that mean?
Well, let me reframe that. I find the arguments a little bit slippery. So I understood tariffs as a way of building manufacturing. But then I also understand tariffs as a sort of tool for Trump to use in bargaining for whatever. And the fact is, we don't really know what kinds of bargains there are that might be being made. It just seems, I think that what Trump really does like and that tariffs allow him to do, and they brag about this in the White House, is to now have people coming to him saying, you know, make a deal with me, I'll give you this, give me this, give me this, you have to. And that's the way he likes to do things. It's problematic in a democracy. Things really should be working through the legislature, but be that as it may, that I think is very much how he sees tariffs.
Right. Yeah.
And he's, you know, fighting the markets on this and everything else.
So over the weekend, there were more of these protests around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people shouting, you know, toting signs and all this sort of stuff. And I saw a photo in one story of a crowd, might have been Harrisburg, I can't remember, where one person near the front of the crowd's got this big sign that says, "Save our democracy."
Mm-hmm.
Is our democracy threatened right now? Just give me an opinion.
Yes.
What do you think? You say yes. Why?
Because I think we're seeing really dangerous authoritarian tendencies in the executive branch. And I think you're seeing it in how he's dealing with the other branches of government. I think you see it in how he's dealing with the bureaucracy below him. And, you know, let's face it, they have this legal theory behind them that I think is going to carry a lot of weight in the court, and that is this idea of the unitary executive that basically says that all power in the executive branch flows up to the president himself. That's why they're taking on all these independent regulatory agencies, and that's why he makes, you know, comments about maybe getting rid of the Powell at the Fed, because the Fed is the ultimate of the independent agencies. And he's basically saying, no way, I control all of these. And, I mean, there's good court precedent that he doesn't, but that doesn't mean that won't change, because I think this unitary executive theory has really worked its way into conservative legal circles and up to the court. But I'm quite disturbed by some of what he does. I think that pardoning of the January 6th people was a very dangerous move, that it conveyed a disrespect for the rule of law. And I think it put dangerous people on the street who feel like, so long as I'm supporting Donald Trump, I got nothing to worry about.
All right, here's my thought. Let's see what mm-hmm. you think. I was not in support of that either. Now, there were some bad actors on January 6th, and we saw them. But there were a lot of, I think, innocent people kind of caught up in the crowd, if you will, that day, that just kind of wandered in and then ended up getting arrested, and all they did was wander in. So those folks essentially didn't do anything. There were some bad actors, but most of the people were just caught in the moment. Or what do you think there?
A couple of responses to that.
All right,
first
go.
Of all, I don't really buy the but. You know, there were some bad actors, but.
Yes.
Because these bad actors attacked police officers.
Yes.
And so they were really bad.
Bad.
And they were pardoned. And so I think you have to first start with that. A lot of the other people that were pardoned weren't in jail, had already served their times, because they were found only guilty of pretty minor things. But what I would mostly point to is I wouldn't ask whether they were innocent or guilty. I would ask whether they had due process or not. And every one of them did. Every one of them had an indictment from a grand jury. Every one of them had either a trial with a jury or they pleaded. And they pleaded because that's what they wanted to do. And if you plead, then you're acknowledging your guilt. So I don't really buy the idea that they didn't, that these were innocent people just swept up by Joe Biden and tossed into this hellhole of a jail in D.C. They had due process. They committed their crimes in D.C. That's what happens to you. But I think releasing them was a very dangerous thing to do. And it conveyed a disrespect for the rule of law that I think you see in a lot of actions. And this is something that you do worry about with authoritarians. I'll tell you the other thing that I really worry about is the fact that there are so limited checks on the people around him in the cabinet that he didn't appoint, you know, the most qualified people. Last time he had people around who could stand up to him because they were highly qualified people. And they had a certain kind of gravitas in their own right, Bill Barr. All right? People in the counsel's office. People in the Defense Department. But consider what he did. You know, he got rid of all the JAGs. So he eliminated this whole sort of legal level of the military. Hegseth was the most qualified person out there, or he was just simply loyal. You know, Matt Gaetz was an original nominee, and even Pat Bondi. You know, the best person you could find for the gravitas to stand up to him in the way that attorney generals have traditionally stood up to presidents? I don't think so. So that part of it concerns me, too, because something that authoritarian-oriented leaders tend to do is put sort of incompetent but highly loyal people around them. And I think we're seeing a lot of that.
Okay. I mean, for the January 6th thing, I'll disagree with you ever so slightly. If I'm a regular Joe and I went to that gig and I got caught up in the crowd and there I am and I get arrested and all I did was show up, you know, I didn't do anything, and here's this massive federal government taking me on, I'm thinking, I'm overwhelmed, of course I'm going to plead. There's no way I'm going to fight this, so I lose.
You see, I just don't. I have a hard time figuring out how somebody walks into the Capitol behind a fog of tear gas, right, from the people at the front, with people lying on the ground, and think, I'm allowed in. This is okay. I just don't buy it. I think they know they were doing something wrong, maybe not that wrong, but something wrong, and some of them were doing a lot wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, we'll just have to
All right.
disagree. Now, do I think we're an authoritarian country right now? No. The guardrails in the American system are very strong. We have a very powerful and strong court system that, you know, for the most part has actually stood up to the administration on a lot of issues. They lose more than they win. We also have other guardrails that I think are still holding. We still have guardrails in the states. We still have guardrails in the federal government. But you ask me if I think we're moving in that direction, and I think we're seeing a lot of dangerous patterns. Ask me after the next election, because I'm curious to see how that election goes.
Next year. The midterms. 26 midterms.
Yeah.
All right. Couple more minutes. Maybe part of this is, all right, you got Republicans, Democrats, an opinion. The Democrat Party at the top levels is a mess. It's a total mess. I mean, who's in charge? Here's an open-ended question. Who's in charge of that party? Is anybody in charge of that party? They just seem to be like meandering all over the place. And that could be a reason why Trump was able to go, go, go and get everything, or try to get everything he wants, because the other side is a mess. What do you think?
I think there could have been a much tighter strategy among Democrats in the Senate. But I don't know. I actually don't really buy into this idea quite the way other people do. There's never a leader of the out party until they have a nominee for the next election. And so we're years away from that. We have leaders in Congress. There are leaders in the state. There are people vying to be the national leader for the next election. But the idea that there's this single person out there that can grab control of the media narrative in a way that they're the spokesperson for the Democratic Party, it just doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, this is what happens when parties lose. They always go into a period of trying to figure out what the heck just happened and what are we going to do in the next election. So, you know, I think that in the Senate, they clearly could have held up some of these nominees, perhaps, and made some trouble, but they're the minority party. And it's hard when you're the minority party to have much ability to do anything.
All right.
So I just don't know how the Democrats would be able to do that.
Now, Trump obviously is the guy on the right, but he's been on the guy on the right for a long time, really.
Yeah.
There's been no person on the left. Kamala Harris was not that person.
No, oh, well, we've talked about this before. I think they made a huge mistake by not having Joe Biden drop out earlier, so that they could have had a primary process or some kind of process to, I thought that was a big problem. I'm not sure they would have won anyway, because I still think the economy and inflation really just pulled Biden down. It'd be hard for anybody to separate from them, but, you know, we're past that.
All right. Last question. Mm-hmm. Josh Shapiro's our governor. Mm-hmm. That bizarre arson that happened at the governor's mansion almost 2 weeks ago now. Just weird. I've driven past the mansion right on Front Street, right along the river. And so I was able, I didn't stop, but I'm driving along and I can see the damage and so on. Shapiro's supposed to be one of the big wigs, if you will, on the Democrat side, maybe for president here in a couple of years. Just a bizarre thought I had yesterday. That mansion fire helped his national aspirations because somebody, if you will, attacked him, which is what happened. And, you know, what has transpired since then? Could something as I'm thinking about Trump and Butler when that kid, whatever, took a shot at him. I mean, Trump's boom, up they went, up his numbers went. Oh, my gosh. Shapiro, somebody tried to burn his house down, essentially. That helps his national aspirations. Is that good or am I crazy? What do you think?
Well, what I mostly think about with this is Reagan in 1981. And, you know, he gets shot.
Yeah.
His popularity numbers just soar. And Tip O'Neill just capitulates on this massive tax cut, saying this guy is so popular that I can't possibly stand in the way. And that was very consequential and a direct result of his getting shot. But I think that for Reagan, I think that for Trump, and maybe we're seeing it for Shapiro, but that election is so far away, I don't know. But it's how they handle themselves, I think, afterwards that makes a difference. You know, Trump standing up and raising his arm and all of that. That was a powerful image. Reagan making jokes to the operating in the operating room and those coming out, that was powerful. And, you know, and I think Shapiro's handled himself with grace and strength. And, of course, it gives a media focus to him. So you're thinking about him because now the camera's on him. You know, but that election, that's a long way. Until the midterms, we don't have any idea who's going to be the presidential candidate.
All right. It's all about the optics. The optics is a lot of politics, isn't
yes, it?
Just the way you perceive and see something.
Yeah, nobody knows that better than the Trump administration. They are focused on optics. I mean, look at all the optics they're putting out around deportation. There's almost an entire theater around their deportation moves.
And he comes out and talks essentially every day, where Joe Biden, you never heard from him for weeks.
Yes.
Optics.
I think it's more than optics. I think it's attention. I think that Trump believes in a kind of theory of politics that says that so long as I'm getting the attention, I'm doing okay. It doesn't even matter. I think he just says crazy stuff sometimes that just so that the attention
I'll agree
will be,
with that,
that
yeah.
the attention will be on him that day. And he gets to dominate. Nobody else. As you're talking about a Democrat, how can any Democrat crack through that, given the attention on the permanent press corps in the White House, all of that? It's until the election, it's just not even possible.
All right. Appreciate your time. Always have great conversations with you. There's just some we disagree on some things, but cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well, have fun with finals. Do you have fun with finals, or is
no,
that not possible?
I do enjoy looking forward to golf season.
Summer break. That's what you want. All right. Thanks again.
All right.
We'll have you again. Thanks again. Dr.